ओम विष्णु पदाय कृष्ण प्रस्ताय भूतले श्रीमते भक्ति वेदांत स्वामिनीति नामने नमस्ते सरस्वती देवे गौरवाणी प्रचारणे निर्विशेषा रंजन शलकाय चक्षुर निरित जैन तस्मा श्री गुरवे नम पंचकृप सिंधु पतितनाम भावदेव्यो वैष्णवेव्यो नमो नम. So the topic this evening is concerns the certain aspect of the Bhagavad Gita, and that's the Bhagavad Gita as the culture of intelligence. By intelligence I mean buddhi. I want to start with reading to you a little part of a purport from Srimad Bhagavatam 2.7.18. So Prabhupada distinguishes different levels of what he here calls civilization. I'm using the word culture, but the same thing. He says, the modern advancement of civilization is based on these activities of the senses. Or in other words, it is a civilization of sense gratification. Perfect civilization is the civilization of Atma, or the soul proper. The civilized man of sense gratification is on an equal level with animals, because animals cannot go beyond the activities of the senses. Above the senses is the mind. The civilization of mental speculation is also not the perfect stage of life, because above the mind is the intelligence. And the Bhagavad Gita gives us information of the intellectual civilization. The Vedic literatures give different directions for the human civilization, including the civilization of the senses, of the mind, of the intelligence, and of the soul proper. The Bhagavad Gita primarily deals with the intelligence of man, leading one to the progressive path of civilization of the spirit soul. And Srimad Bhagavatam is the complete human civilization dealing with the subject matter of the soul proper. As soon as a man is raised to the status of the civilization of the soul, he is fit to be promoted to the kingdom of God. So here Prabhupada is distinguishing, if we're looking at within one society, we can call them four levels of culture. I like the word culture in this context because it also has to do with cultivating or developing. So in everywhere you see, we are in a culture or civilization of sense gratification. There's so many enterprises, so many activities, so many institutions simply meant for satisfying the senses. There are restaurants and there are health spas, and so many things are just there for enjoying the body. Senses means the body. Then he says above that there's the above the senses is the mind, the civilization of mental speculation. This culture, the culture of the mind, we see in our institutions like universities and colleges. This takes place, mental speculation, on the platform of the mind. What happens on the platform of mental speculation is people entertain themselves with various theories and ideas. They look at them, they mentally play with them, they see what implications there are. Then after a while they get tired of a certain idea and they set it aside and take up another idea. It's been noted by people other than me that in the history of philosophy, for example, There's nothing like clear progress. We go through stages. You will see in Western philosophy, sometimes they say, well, in the modern philosophy begins with rationalism. That is to say, Descartes, Spinoza, Leibniz, as we call it, rationalism. And then that is, succeeding that, then we get empiricism, especially from England, Locke, Berkeley, Hume. Then after that, switches mostly to Germany, the leader, idealism, Kant, Hegel, Fichte, and so on. Like this, you get one style of philosophy superseded by another, followed by another, followed by another. But it's been pointed out, it's not that anybody refutes a philosophy, one style of philosophy or one doctrine. It's just that it's not that we decide, oh, this has these defects, let's go on to something else. It's that basically people just get tired of doing it. And they decide this is now, we're going to do something else. And they switch to another style of philosophy. And so you have what amounts to changes in intellectual fashion. And it happens for no more reasons than this year's skirts are short and then next year suddenly they're long. And this year red is in and then next year red is out and black is in. Just like changes of fashion. This is the mental platform. But when you come to the platform of the culture of intelligence, this Prabhupada said the place for this is Bhagavad Gita. And this is a very interesting statement, because true intelligence, buddhi, which is above manas, is therefore really not very much understood or appreciated. In our, the highest we tend to go in our civilization is the culture of the mind. So this Bhagavad Gita is the culture of intelligence. We have to see why that is. Then beyond that, the culture of the soul itself, which is embodied in Srimad Bhagavatam. In another place, Prabhupada distinguishes he's talking about the mind. Our desires are, we're manufacturing different desires because the mind's business is concoction, accepting something, rejecting something. As we'll see, the basic function of the mind is to accept and reject on the basis of immediate sense gratification. Does it please the senses? Is it unpleasant to the senses? Then it's accepted or rejected. Prabhupada said, this is going on, but by intelligence we come to a certain conclusion. So one who is above the activities of the mind, one who has learned how to use his intelligence, that art is called buddhi yoga. Yoga on the platform of intelligence. So you notice in the Bhagavad Gita, in the second chapter, devotional service is really introduced as buddhi yoga, the yoga on the platform of intelligence. Prabhupada says, then he talks about the three, the different platforms, the senses, the mind. Material life means sensuous life, but those who are a little above, they are on the mental platform, poetry, philosophy, mental speculation. Above this, there is intelligence. That intellectual life is required. That means we have to transcend the position of the sensuous life. We have to transcend the position of concocted mental speculation. We have to come to the intellectual platform. That intellectual platform is called Brahma Jignasa. Atato Brahma Jignasa. That is inquiry into the absolute truth. And when we exercise this intellectual path of our life, that is called Buddhi Yogam. Then in another place, again, he talks about the yoga means to control the mind. By controlling the mind, you can control the senses, because mind is the master of the senses. Then above the mind, still finer, is the intelligence. So you can train up your mind with intelligence. So here you see how the function of intelligence, just as the mind controls the senses, the intelligence controls the mind. People who are on the mental platform, they may be very, very adept at being active or clever on the mental platform, and will do well in what we call an IQ test, supposedly in test your intelligence, but actually in terms of what this means, by buddhi, they have no intelligence, even though they are, in some material terms, smart people. Still there's no buddhi. Because above the mind, still finer, is intelligence. So you can train up your mind with intelligence. And then that is the best intelligence when one engages the mind in Krishna consciousness. Then you will get instruction from the Supreme Personality of Godhead sitting anywhere. So then this is what we find out in the Bhagavad Gita. If it's the culture of intelligence, I mean, if the Bhagavad Gita is meant for the formation of intelligence, Bildung of intelligence, then when that intelligence is fully formed, then you get instruction from the Supreme Personality of Godhead. So these things can be understood gradually after purifying the mind. See, if the mind is purified by the intelligence, then you can go to these higher levels of understanding. People who do not do this, who do not try to purify the mind, who speculate with the mind without trying to purify, they never go beyond this. At the present moment, on account of our material contamination, our mind is contaminated with so many things, so many material things. If you purify your mind, then you come to the spiritual platform. That is intelligence, via media between spirit and the mind. Prabhupada, another place in the Bhagavad Gita, calls intelligence the next door neighbor of the soul. Again, Prabhupada says, we have to go to the platform of soul, that is spiritual education. But there are so many other stages. Somebody, he's stopping in the mind, that is, he gets as far as the mind and doesn't go to the next stage. He's thinking this is the final thing, philosophy, poetry, imagination, mental speculation. As we see, mostly your Western philosophers, they are stuck up on the platform of the mind, that's all. Then he mentions, as far as he can see, the only one that he knows that got any farther was Socrates. Went to the platform of the soul. So then he mentions, so those who are in the lowest stage of knowledge, they are in the bodily concept of life, the indriya, the senses, just like cats and dogs. They cannot think any more than that. But Krishna advises, so Krishna advises, no, don't stop here. Indriyani parani ahu, that's the Bhagavad Gita 3:42. Bodily concept of life, sense pleasure, they think it is all. There is no more other. Those who are little above the bodily concept of life, they find pleasure in the mind. And farther, they find pleasure in intellectually, in intelligence. And in this way, then he says, the thing is very complicated. It requires very cool brain to understand all these things. But those who are meat eaters, they are very troubled. They cannot understand. For them, the subject matter is very, very difficult. So in this way, the mind has to be pure. Then one can come to the actual platform of intelligence, then you can be, we can begin to understand the spirit. So if you want to know why today no one can understand, if you mention the soul, you mention God, they just don't have any idea what you're talking about. This is why they are not capable of understanding these things, because there's no purification. Anyway, there's so this is the idea of these different platforms. Senses, the mind, the intelligence. In the Bhagavad Gita 3:42, Krishna mentions these things. The working senses are superior to dull matter. Mind is higher than the senses. Intelligence is still higher than the mind. And he, the soul, is higher still for the intelligence. Now, the question is, what is, do we mean by buddhi, actually, and how to cultivate buddhi? So we can see from these quotations I read you that the higher culture of intelligence is not comprehensible. They cannot understand it to those who are only on the mental platform. And very rarely, at least in my study of philosophy, do you ever see anybody come even close to the intellectual platform? Now, so that's why where we really want to understand buddhi, the best place is this Bhagavad Gita. And another thing that we should understand that's very, very important about buddhi is that buddhi is the instrument or the agent for the correct placement of faith. It is not that, as we will see, everyone has some faith. There's no living being, no human being that does not have faith. Even this is stated in the Bhagavad Gita, Shraddhamaya Ayam Purushaha. This the human being is Shraddhamaya. This is in the divisions of faith. What's that? Chapter 17. Shraddhamaya Ayam Purushaha. The human being is made of faith. Because everybody, we think and feel and will in a certain mental framework. We have a outlook on life, we have a Weltanschauung, we've taken it in with our mother's milk, or maybe we've studied somewhere, but somehow or other, we have a very basic way of seeing the world, and in every case, it's based on faith. Everybody has some faith. I meet people, they say, oh, you're a religious guy, so what you have is faith, but I don't believe in anything. I'm a skeptic. And if you start to press the claims of faith, they get angry and insist that there is no truth. And then you have to say, if there is no truth, what about your conviction that there is no truth? Is that true or not? So you find that these people are skeptics. Actually, they have a great deal of faith in their skepticism. They're not skeptical enough to be skeptical about their own skepticism. They have faith also on this matter. So actually, everyone has some faith. Their view of the world, especially if it's unified, it has some basic foundation that it rests upon, and you will find out that it's always an act of faith. is how do we place our faith correctly? What should we believe in? Is there any method for finding out how do we place our faith? That's what Buddha is about. So it's good to know this, because we can actually get ourselves in the position that we will be able to correctly place our faith. Because faith has to be there anyway. In any case. So let us see what Bodhi actually is. There's a description of Bodhi by Kapiladeva when he gives his Sankhya analysis of various things. So he says to his mother, by transformation of the false ego in passion, intelligence takes birth. This is the third canto, chapter 26. The functions of intelligence are to help in ascertaining the nature of objects when they come into view and to help the senses. He then goes on. Doubts, misapprehension, correct apprehension, memory, and sleep, as determined by their different functions, are said to be the distinct characteristics of intelligence. So, intelligence works in everybody. Everybody has got some intelligence. Prabhupada says, in the second canto, intelligent gives one direction like some higher authority, and the living being cannot see or move or eat or do anything without the use of intelligence. When one fails to take advantage of intelligence, he becomes a deranged man, and so a living being is dependent on intelligence or the direction of a superior being. Now, what this means is, when it's talking about intelligence, ascertain the nature of objects when it comes into view to help the senses, this is the phenomena of recognition. If we talk about the visual senses, you look at something and you see a pattern of shapes and colors. That's what comes into the eyeball. Just this gestalt of this. But you don't just see a pattern of shapes and colors, you see a cow. You recognize this for something. Or you see, every time you see something, you don't just see what's really there. I see different human beings in front of me. I could recognize some are male, some are female, and so on. Maybe I know somebody, then I immediately recognize their face. This is the phenomena of recognition. We don't just see something, but we always see something as something. So where does this recognition come from? It means that I have somehow absorbed a way of already seeing the world. Actually, I took it in from my mother, with my mother's milk, practically. When I learned a language, somebody pointed out, see, that's a cow. I'm just a little baby, I don't know anything. Cow, bird, house, dog. We even give them little picture books, they can look at these things. How am I learning? I'm learning from an authority. I'm a child. I have to learn from authority. It's the only way you can learn is from an authority. And as a little baby, I have faith. And this is how, in the beginning, my intelligence begins to be formed. In a certain way, by the authority that I have got, usually my parents in the beginning. And in this way, from all the people around me as a little child, I gradually build up a whole way of looking at the world, a whole way of identifying everything. So that is my intelligence. The mind itself just sees some colors, shapes and everything, but it, because there's some intelligence, it helps the senses see what something is. And of course, it works on the very basic level of perception, and then more and more higher mental levels also. There's intelligence, there's scientific theories and so on, and all those things have intelligence working in the background, so that when we see something, we can identify it and recognize what it is. Here's the other way the intelligence has to be there. The mind accepts and rejects simply on the basis of sense gratification. If we have no intelligence, we could not even walk across the room. We couldn't get through the day. Because of the functions, because if any time you want to do any goal-directed activity, some intelligence has to come into play, because we have to sometimes overrule the mind. If I just on the mental platform, I will not want to get out of the warm bed in a cold room in the morning. I will not maybe want to go through the trouble of brushing my teeth. I do these things out of habit now because, again, some authority has told me I must do these things. So on the very basic level, here's how intelligence works. Let us say that I have a cold or some sickness, and the doctor has given me some medicine to take, some liquid. I put it in a spoon, I put it in my mouth, and my first reaction is to spit it out. Pugh! Because it's very bitter. It tastes terrible. And I just want to spit it out. See, that's the mind. Immediately rejected. It tastes bad. But because I know that I've heard from the doctor, the authority, that I need to take this for my health, and then the long term, long range, it will be good for me, I swallow it anyway. My intelligence has overruled the reaction of my mind. If I'm there's a little baby and you have to give them some medicine, then because babies and children have very little intelligence, somebody has to somehow force them to take it or mix it up with something or like that. Because they even though you could tell, oh, you'll get better, the doctor says to take it, they don't pay any attention. They're just controlled by the mind. So you can see how intelligence has to work in this way all the time. Otherwise, as Prabhupada said, we would just be crazy. Sometimes you see, I've been in places where, I watch people smoking marijuana. And you can see the intelligence go away. And they cannot do any long-term goal-directed activity because it just temporarily dissolves what little intelligence they are holding on to. So this phenomena of doing long-term goal-directed activity and of being able to see the world in a coherent, organized way of recognizing things, these are some of the functions of intelligence. It says memory because recognition depends upon also memory, even though sometimes it's a memory we're not even conscious of. So everyone has got some intelligence, and the intelligence is working in that way. And so when Krishna is starting to talk about Buddhi Yoga, what is the function of intelligence? It's to control the senses, it's to control the mind, and it's to control the senses. So that by doing that, one can act in the world without being attached to the results. That is to say, that we will now not act anymore for sense gratification. We will still act in the world, so there will still be the movement of the senses and the activities of the senses, but no longer now will we be driven by sense gratification. That is to say, we will not now be under the control of the mind, but the mind will be controlled by the intelligence. This is why this is called buddhi yoga. And when we begin to discuss in the sixth chapter of the Bhagavad Gita, we begin to hear about yoga. Prabhupada says the first thing we need to know is how to control the mind. That yoga, the yoga system, is really about controlling the mind. When the beginning of the sixth chapter, I think text number 5. Again, this what controls the mind is really the intelligence. He says here, one must deliver himself with the help of his mind and must not degrade himself. The mind is the friend of the conditioned soul and the enemy as well. For him who has conquered the mind is the best of friends. But for one who has failed to do so, his mind will remain the greatest enemy. So Prabhupada says the purpose of the yoga system is to control the mind and to draw it away from attachment to sense objects. So that's what it is. The mind must be trained so that it will not be attracted by the glitter of material nature, and in this way the conditioned soul may be saved. So what we do, for example, in our Krishna conscious system of yoga, is we reprogram the mind. Think of the mind as a computer. And we're going to reprogram it. And that when the mind is a computer, it means that it is, in a certain way, the way it remembers and sees things is now in terms of sense gratification. When I look at food, I will accept it or reject it, be attracted toward it or away from it, simply on the basis of whether I will like the way it tastes or not. When I meet other human beings, I accept and reject them on the basis of sense gratification. Will this person be is this person an attractive sexual object or not? I will evaluate like that, size them up immediately. Or will this person, being friends with this person, increase my social status or decrease it? Whatever my particular, can I make money with this from this person or not? Anyway, I evaluate them, accept and reject, simply on the basis of my sense gratification. And if we're in material consciousness, our whole mind has been programmed. And why has it been programmed that way? Because we have a certain faith. What is our faith? Our faith is that by gratifying the senses, I will achieve happiness and success in life. That's my faith. But now we have discovered, we have come to an opposite conclusion, that the world is just different, and that actually, as Krishna says, that the pleasures that arise from sense contact with the senses and the objects are the source of all suffering. Now we know that. And so now we have to do something about the fact that our perception, the way we see things, because our intelligence is contaminated, we only see everything and accept and reject in terms of sense gratification. So when we practice buddhi yoga, now when I go shopping for foodstuffs, I think, I will prepare a feast for Krishna. And I will now accept and reject. The mind still accepts and rejects. But now if I'm doing it correctly, if I'm shopping in Krishna consciousness, I'm looking to buy those things that will please Krishna. And then I accept and reject. Now I'm not thinking of my sense gratification, but of Krishna's sense gratification. When I meet another human being, again, I think, I'm thinking of this person, I'm accepting, rejecting in the sense that, will this person become a devotee or not? Or will this person take a book or not? So what does that mean? I'm thinking, can I bring this person to Krishna for Krishna to enjoy? So again, then by this way, by engaging in Krishna's service in this way, using our senses in this way, gradually we develop different mental habits. We start to, our impure memory becomes cleaned up. And then we start to gradually see everything as belonging to Krishna. And again, my own senses, I think of instruments to satisfy Krishna. So in this way, the way I see and act in the world becomes completely changed. That is to say, I've reprogrammed my mind. It was programmed one way for sense gratification, then now therefore it's my enemy. Because now I am not going to follow this path anymore. And now I'm going to follow another path. I have to make the mind my friend by retraining it. So this is the intelligence. I've received instructions how to do this from Krishna, from the spiritual master. I'm following those instructions. And now by my intelligence, my mind is being reformatted, reprogrammed. The mind is very stupid. It's just like this automatic condition. It just accepts and rejects in this way. Now, by the way, when we go through this, this is the mind, obviously, we have decided to become devotees. We've accepted the instruction of Krishna. But we discovered, much to our embarrassment, that although I have decided to become a devotee, my mind has not. Because the mind has what they call inertia, you know, just the tendency to keep going in the same way. And it wants to continue on the path of sense gratification. Now it becomes my enemy. So the first thing that happens for most of us when we start on the path of Krishna consciousness, we feel like we're divided. American philosopher William James, who wrote a book called The Varieties of Religious Experience, has a whole chapter on the divided self. This is common enough. St. Paul has a very famous passage about this in the letters to the Romans. How he wants to do one thing, but his senses want to do something else, and so on. So it's not unhealthy. Even though one may feel awkward, and at least your friends may comment on it. This is what happened to me. I became a devotee, and all my old friends, they met me and they said, "What's wrong with you? You're so uptight. You know, you used to be so together, and now you're obviously not at ease with yourself anymore. This Krishna consciousness must not be good for you." But it's not unhealthy, because for a while it will feel not very, you will not feel at home in your own mind. But then after the mind becomes trained, then again you're together. You're now you can flow with it. Once the mind is your friend, it'll be programmed for Krishna consciousness. Once the habits are there, if I have the habits of, once habits have been established, I get up in the morning, I do not decide whether or not I shall brush my teeth. I just do it. So when we have the habits of Krishna consciousness, we do not decide, shall I get up in the morning, shall I go to Mangal Arati? The habits are there. That's because the mind has now been trained by the intelligence. So we have to discriminate in this way. It is also this intelligence that is at the basis of our whole outlook on life, that has given us this basic faith by which we act on things. Most people do not know that they have made an act of faith. Somebody like me, who had a certain materialistic outlook on life, and then changed, rejected it and became a devotee. I know what it is to commit myself to something on faith. Ultimately, I had to commit myself to Krishna consciousness on faith. I was in a PhD program in religious studies. It wasn't that I didn't think, I thought day and night about this. But I could see that I had to make a decision. I was attracted to Krishna consciousness. Should I accept it? Well, every time I thought of a reason why I should accept Krishna consciousness, I found that all my arguments for it already presupposed Krishna consciousness. You understand what I'm saying? And then when I thought, well, I shouldn't become a devotee, why I should keep with the modern outlook on life, all the arguments I gave for that presupposed that modern outlook on life. I could find no neutral ground I could find no neutral ground. In other words, this decision between Krishna consciousness and material life was so deep that it completely divided everything. There was no third position from which you could evaluate. You could either this one or that one, but only from inside. So it was a particular kind of naked decision, what some call a leap of faith sometimes. But then I realized that if I became a devotee based on this faith, it was equally an act of faith to be not a devotee. And so then I had to choose. I realized suddenly I was getting direction from Krishna. So I chose. I want to read you Bhagavad Gita 2, 67. I'm fond of this verse because the very first time I saw devotees, they were chanting. I was in my third year of graduate school. There was a small group of devotees chanting on campus, and I was sort of interested because I was studying religion, and here the missionaries were coming from east to west for a change. So I went up to a devotee and started to talk to him, and he sold me a little booklet for 50 cents. And it was called Two Essays. And the first essay was called Who is Crazy? Because actually, my very first reaction when I saw devotees was, I'll never do anything like that, you know, jumping up and down. Well, famous last words, as we say. And this lecture was a lecture by Prabhupada that had been transcribed, written down, And the lecture was on this Bhagavad Gita 269. And this goes like this. Here it is, I have it marked. What is night for all beings is the time of awakening for the self-controlled. And the time of awakening for all beings is night for the introspective sage. Here in the context of this, Krishna has described Buddhi Yoga. And by developing this Buddhi Yoga, you become a Stita Di Muni, a sage of steady intelligence. Di also means another word for intelligence. One who has controlled his senses completely. And so he is urging on Arjuna this path of controlling the senses. For one thus satisfied, the threefold miseries of material existence exist no longer. In such a satisfied consciousness, one's intelligence is soon well established. One who is not connected with the Supreme can have neither transcendental intelligence nor a steady mind, without which there is no possibility of peace. And how can there be any happiness without peace? As a strong wind sweeps away a boat on water, even one of the roaming senses on which the mind focuses can carry away a man's intelligence. Therefore, O mighty armed, one whose senses are restrained from their objects is certain of steady intelligence. This is the way Krishna has been talking. And then he says, what is night for all beings is the time of awakening for the self-controlled. And the time of awakening for all beings is night for the introspective sage. What this is saying is when a devotee is active and alert and paying attention. Let me back up a little bit. One of the things that intelligence controls is attention. When you go into a room, what do you notice and what do you not notice? What attracts your attention and what you don't see? What do you find interesting? What do you find not interesting? Even before you see, there's been a selection process directing your attracting your attention toward things and ignoring other things. That is intelligence. So here, here's one who's the sage of steady intelligence. Wherever he goes, he sees certain things. He's alert. He notices certain things, attracted to certain things. But so it's like day to him. But in his daytime, everybody else is asleep. They don't notice anything. You come into the temple, there are the deities, there's Bhagavatam, there are devotees. But a guy who stopped in here thinking this was maybe another place to get a beer, he comes in, he says, no, what's happening here? Nothing. Nothing's going on, right? So what is night for all beings, when everybody else is asleep, what they see is nothing. To the person who's a devotee, with the time of awakening for the self-controlled. And the time of awakening for all beings, what they're alert to and interested in, is night for the introspective sage. It actually is Sanskrit, that is night for the sage who sees. Now I want you to, the first line of Prabhupada's purport. There are two classes of intelligent men. So notice this word, the use of the word intelligence. It means the attention has been directed by the intelligence either this way or that way. There are two classes of intelligent men. One is intelligent in material activities for sense gratification. And the other is introspective and awake to the cultivation of self-realization. Activities of the introspective sage or thoughtful man are night for persons materially absorbed. Materialistic people remain asleep in such a night due to their ignorance of self-realization and so on. So see how Prabhupada is using the word intelligence here, the two classes of intelligence, how they, what they are. And this is the, fundamentally, our intelligence on the most basic level can be oriented toward directing us toward the path of sense gratification or the path of self-realization. And then Krishna tells us that if we are going to be successful, he's first of all urged this path of self-realization. He's contrasted it to those people who are followers of the Vedas but interested in sense gratification, and urged on this path of urged this path of Buddha Yoga. And then he says, if you want to be successful, you must have this vyavasa atmika buddhi. Your intelligence has to be very fixed and steadfast and determined. Again, intelligence, any long-term goal-directed activity requires some degree of intelligence. Now for this one, you have to be single-minded in your purpose. I guess this is one way to say vyavasa atmika buddhi. Your aim, you can only really want one thing. Because those who are materialists, their intelligence is bahu-chaka. They have many things they are interested in. Well, what this means for us is that if you want to be a devotee and successful in this path, Krishna consciousness cannot be one thing among many in your lives. Today, most people, if they have a religion, it's something that's added on. It's like a kind of a hobby that they do once a week or something like that. Otherwise, they have many things they're interested in. They have their profession. They have their social life or family life. They have some political interest. They have some hobby. And oh yes, they have their religion. And they're all these things they're interested in. If the Krishna consciousness for us is like that, one thing among many, we will not succeed. It has to be the one thing. That doesn't mean that we won't do other things, but everything else we do has to help or be in support of this main thing. If it does not contribute to it, then we should reject it. So then Krishna says, those people who are motivated by the desire for sense gratification and opulence, this vyavasa atmika buddhi does not take place. So we do have to make a choice. If we would like, as yes, I like Krishna consciousness, but I also like sense gratification a lot, let me have some happy synthesis, the best of both worlds, you will not do very well. Krishna consciousness, because you have to want one thing, and that has to be the main thing. So if we embark on this Buddha Yoga platform and we undergo the purification necessary, then we will discover in the course of time that our intelligence is really being directed from the outside, or something from the outside. Our intelligence, when it becomes purified, turns out to be actually the direction given to us by the Super Soul. In other words, as our intelligence becomes purified, we will gradually see that that's where it is ultimately coming from. The Super Soul is directing everybody's intelligence, as it turns out. I'm situated in everyone's heart, and from me comes remembrance, knowledge, and forgetfulness. When people want to turn away from Krishna, Krishna is the one that gives them the intelligence to turn away from him. Prabhupada remarked, there are so many arguments, there is no God, God is dead, and so on. He said, where do these arguments come from? They come from Krishna. When you want to forget Krishna, Krishna gives you the intelligence to forget him, And when you want to remember, he gives you the intelligence to remember. So in any case, the intelligence, and that's why Prabhupada, I want to conclude with this Srimad Bhagavatam 2.2.20.35. This is a very important verse. Its translation is this: the personality of Godhead, Lord Sri Krishna, is in every living being along with the individual soul. And this fact is perceived and hypothesized, and it was understood by inference, in our acts of seeing and taking help from the intelligence. And now there's a long purport, and I cannot, I once gave a week-long series of lectures on this one purport. How, by looking at how your intelligence works, you can see the super soul. And Prabhupada gives a procedure here, how to do it. But he says here, actually the Lord is not, the Lord is not perceivable by our present materialized senses. But when one is convinced of the presence of the Lord by a practical service attitude, there is a revelation by the Lord's mercy, and such a pure devotee of the Lord can perceive the Lord's presence always and everywhere. He can perceive that intelligence, again buddhi, is the form direction of the Paramatma plenary portion of the personality of Godhead. So Prabhupada has made up this word, form direction. It's a hyphen in the middle. The form direction. This means this intelligence is the form in which the super soul gives us direction. That's my understanding of this word. It is a form of the super soul who gives us direction. And therefore, if the pure, if it's possible that to perceive the super soul, he gives a whole procedure, which we don't have time to get into. And this is where he remarks, intelligence gives one direction like some higher authority, and the living being cannot see or move or eat or do anything without the use of intelligence. When one fails to take advantage of intelligence, he becomes a deranged man, and so a living being is dependent on intelligence or the direction of superior beings. You remember I talked about when we're children, our intelligence first becomes formed by the direction of our parents. Now, if we lived in a whole society, in a God-conscious society, our parents would actually be the representatives of God. Anyone who has any power or authority over anyone else is a natural representative of God. And the whole breakdown of our culture and our civilization stems from the fact that those people who are supposed to represent God do not. Bhagavatam gives a list like that: a mother, a father, an older relative, a political leader, a teacher. All these people, spiritual master, they are all supposed to be representatives of God. In Indian tradition, the mother is called Adi Guru. She's the first spiritual master. Because actually, you learn so much. These people, all of them, are supposed, your mother and father, you get your idea of God from them. They're all-powerful parents who satisfy all your needs and on whom you're completely dependent. So when actually they actually really represent God, then your intelligence is in order almost from the very beginning. Otherwise, we have to go through difficulty because our intelligence has been malformed, badly formed. Like, for example, when I became a devotee of Krishna, here's an example of I learned from the authority, in this case not my parents, but from the Bhagavad Gita, about something called the three modes of nature. I never heard of them before. I didn't know what they meant. I gradually understood what they meant. And then, so here's the categories, the three modes of nature. And then I learned how to recognize the three modes of nature, to see in me what was happening in my own mind that was either goodness, passion, or ignorance, and then other people. And suddenly, looking at the world in terms of three modes, it lit up in a certain way. I saw things I never saw before. So that came from an authority. Originally the Bhagavad Gita. I accepted it, and then when you kind of take it, and then boom, the whole world lights up in a certain way. So when we come to Krishna consciousness, we receive things. Everything, the way we look at the world through Krishna consciousness, is helpful. It directs us toward our main, our real purpose in life. It is developing love of God. The three modes of nature will not help me build atomic bombs or bridges. It's not useful for that purpose, but it's useful for this purpose. At the end of this purport I was reading, Prabhupada talks about the super self. The individual is completely dependent on the direction of the super self in every step. And he's shown this, how every, I cannot move my hand, I cannot blink my eye without the help of the super soul. Because in every step, the individual self follows the direction of the super selves in the matter of seeing, hearing, thinking, feeling, willing, etc. This is actually quite good news, because we begin to realize how close we are with Krishna. And then Prabhupada goes, as far as common sense is concerned, we come to the conclusion that there are three identities, namely matter, spirit, and super spirit. Now, if we go to the Bhagavad Gita, or the Vedic intelligence, so here's what he calls the Bhagavad Gita, the Vedic intelligence. We can further understand that all three identities, namely matter, individual spirit, and super spirit, are all dependent on the Supreme Personality of Godhead. So, here, and later on he says, the Bhagavad Gita is the preliminary conception of the Personality of Godhead, Sri Krishna. And Srimad Bhagavatam is the further explanation of the science of Godhead. That's where we said the culture of the intelligence and culture of the soul proper. So if we stick to our determination, again, that's another function of intelligence, sticking to our determination, and pray for the mercy of the director of the intelligence situated within the same bodily tree, like a bird sitting with another bird, as explained in the Upanishad, certainly the purport of the revealed information in the Vedas becomes clear to our vision, and there's no difficulty in realizing the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Vasudeva. So the process of the Bhagavad Gita, or Vedic intelligence, is in the beginning, we place our confidence or our trust in it. We, by that confidence and trust, we follow the process with determination. And then those things which we have accepted in the beginning on faith become, as he says here, clear to our vision. In other words, it results in direct perception. That's why Prabhupada calls it science of self-realization, of vijnana. That one has the determination to follow this path and follow the process, and then all the revealed, the purport to the revealed information of the Vedas becomes clear to our vision. And so this is where ultimately the formation of intelligence leads us. This is not. When we talk about the intelligence, when we talk about the Lord, we're not talking about now simply something that's we're reading about in a text. If we apply it, we will see it. The super soul is as much in me or in this body as I am. And actually the fact of the matter is that when Krishna is known, he's known beyond any doubt. Prabhupada appreciated René Descartes when he came to the point of consciousness. You know, Descartes decided to engage on the path of systematic doubt. He would doubt everything that was doubtable. He even was going to doubt that the world was in front of his face, because maybe I'm being deceived by an evil demon.
Maybe what?
I'm being deceived. Maybe this world I see is actually a deception. This is before the Matrix came out. Yeah, but the same idea was there. Maybe, and so I can't even trust my sense perception, because maybe there's an evil demon who's projecting everything on me. So what is it that I cannot doubt? And then he came up with this famous cogito ergo sum. He was writing in Latin. I think, therefore, I am. But what he meant is that his own consciousness he could not doubt. He could not doubt his own doubting, because who was doubting? So the fact that he was doubting, that was, you couldn't doubt that. So that his own consciousness was certain. So that's the foundation of, so Prabhupada appreciated this, it came to consciousness. So just as we know our own conscious existence without any doubt, we're the Atma, the Self. But what is the Super Soul? He's the Self of all Selves. He's also Atma. This means that when I begin to come to know Krishna, I cannot doubt his existence as immediate as my own. I cannot doubt his existence. I may doubt this world around me, that maybe I may be in the Matrix or whatever. All those things. But you cannot doubt the existence of the Super Soul. He's discovered by the intelligence, and then this is part of the aspect that we are part and parcel. We are part and parcel of Krishna. And that's why he says self-realization and God-realization, they go together. So we come to this point. So as the Bhagavad Gita gradually unfolds in his teaching of Buddha Yoga in the 10th chapter, Krishna finally says quite openly to those who are constantly devoted and who worship me with love, the Dami Buddha Yoga Tam, I give them the Buddha Yoga. I give them the intelligence by which they can come to me. And so the devotee experiences in very practical ways the direct guidance of the Lord. And that becomes, as we surrender to Krishna, he more and more takes control. Prabhupada remarked that when a devotee is pure, the Lord directly controls his senses. Again, working through the intelligence like that. So this is the Bhagavad Gita. It is definitely a science. It directs us to the placement of faith, but also tells us how to develop our intelligence, so that faith, like faith anywhere, is really just the start of a process of knowledge. See, any process of knowledge begins in faith. You go to a university, you take any course, you at least have faith in the teacher that they're going to teach you something. You take it all in. If immediately you walk into the classroom and you challenge everything they say, they'll say, what are you doing here? You don't think we can teach you anything, why do you come? So that's true. Every process of knowledge begins in faith. This is no different. But here we actually see something which I do not see anywhere else in such a clear and explicit way about the formation and the development of intelligence, so one can actually understand how the actor, how we actually place our faith, how we actually, our mind is controlled by the intelligence, how the intelligence is controlled by super soul, and if we follow the process of Buddhi Yoga, all this will become immediately apparent to us. Okay, I'll stop there. Any questions? Or comments? Yeah, in the back, all the way.
On one level, when you explain, it's not so easy to grasp on the level of intelligence. And I want to ask, because it seems to me that Krishna is kind of like, make a jump and make it very easy when he says,
yeah, sure.
And it seems so easy, everybody can do it.
Correct.
So where did the intelligence go at that point when it became so easy?
Oh, well, it just the intelligence is there. If you're very lucky, you just follow Krishna's directions and you do it. But you notice when you offer a leaf, fruit, flower, or water with love and devotion to Krishna, you're already you've agreed to do that, and so you're making a different use of leaf, fruit, flower, and water than you have before. And also you're developing an affectionate relationship by this act. So in other words, anyone who simply is able, has endowed by good fortune with, you could say, simple faith in the Bhagavad Gita, is very, very fortunate. People like me who, you know, have way past that good fortune, then we have more complicated things to do to understand what's happening when you offer leaf, food, flower, water to Krishna. Yeah, but he does. We're very lucky because all these things that Krishna gives us in devotional service is very simple and very direct and very immediate. But he spends so many verses in the Bhagavad Gita showing Arjuna that if he does this, he will fulfill all the purposes of the Vedas. That if he just surrendered, that's why he says, Sarva Dharman Parijaja Mame Kam Saranam Braja. You can give up all these other things and come to me directly. But just so long as you'll know, Krishna shows that if you're practicing yoga, if you understand what yoga really is, if you become successful in yoga, you'll become his devotee. If you're a jnani, well, after many births and much trouble, you'll surrender to him. If you're worshipping the devatas, you're actually worshipping him, but in a wrong way. If you're practicing different kinds of yajnas or sacrifices, he spends a lot of time talking about how sacrifice gradually leads to the realization of Krishna. So that if you have any doubts, all those doubts are resolved. Doubt's also a function of intelligence, as Kapila pointed out. So that's why that's all there. Okay? Yeah.
Thank you very much. What came over to me is that really life is a lot about concentration, where you concentrate your energies. Uh-huh. And there the super soul will help you to make advancement in that direction. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Where you concentrate your faith, there as well you will get results. Like when you said, it's difficult to mix Krishna consciousness with so many things. You better make Krishna consciousness your main focus, and everything else is a support to Krishna consciousness. Now this concentration, I want to ask you a question on concentration. What helps me to concentrate? Is it a matter of intelligence? Is it a matter of attraction? Is it a matter of maybe cleaning up your table, so to say, and then after having put order into your life and into your table, then you will feel a happy energy which will help you to concentrate. How do we concentrate on Krishna consciousness? And I'm asking this question particularly because I think it is obvious for any sincere practitioner that our concentration on Krishna consciousness will be severely challenged by so many other correct. Things.
Yeah.
So please teach us the art of concentration.
That's yoga means to concentrate the mind. This is what Prabhupada said. Yoga means concentrate the mind by controlling the senses. And so this concentration means for us to pay attention to one thing to the exclusion of something else. I'm reading a book and somebody's talking to me. I said, stop, I'm trying to concentrate. Right? So we don't want distractions. So one thing is the removal of distractions. And a distraction is a form of pramadaha, inattentiveness, huh? Pramadaha, being distracted ultimately from Krishna. So one way we improve our concentration by becoming free from distractions. And one has to, of course, and the practice of this yoga means also the focusing of the attention on Krishna. Krishna says, wherever the mind wanders, bring it back, and again, concentrate it on the Supreme, the mind wanders. Arjuna objects to this because it says it's too hard. The mind is like a wind. You can't control it. But Krishna says, no, it's possible. And he says, it takes two things. One thing is abhyasa, and the other thing is vairagya. The word abhyasa means repetitive practice, repetition. It's like when you want to do anything well, you have to practice. You want to learn a musical instrument, if you don't practice every day, 2, 6, 8 hours, whatever. You want to become good at some sport, you have to practice. So we have a practice, abhyasa yoga. And we do it as repetition. And by repetition, we attain concentration. The mind, I fix the mind, I'm going to chant my japa, I fix my mind at the holy name, and the next thing, whoops, somehow or other, how do I start thinking about that? I don't know, but I bring it back. Then it goes away this way, and I bring it back. And I'm trying to control the mind. This is hopeless. No, I just keep doing, I keep practicing, I keep practicing, and gradually it becomes easier. The other thing, that's abhyasa. And by this abhyasa yogena yuktena gamina mana by this practice abhyasa yoga one attains the Supreme, Krishna says in 8th chapter. Other thing is vairagya by detachment or renunciation. Those two things have to be together. I cannot concentrate the mind on Krishna if my mind is always agitating for sense gratification. So then I have to take up some discipline and with the intelligence beat up my mind or whatever, withhold it from its demands until it comes around my way. I have to train it. So he said these two things. Of course, when actually we are able to concentrate on Krishna, because it's Krishna we're concentrating on, that very concentration turns out to be the seed of love. And when there's concentration on Krishna, the next thing we'll feel is Krishna also concentrating on us. There's some reciprocation, and there, just from that attention, there'll be feeling. Maybe my feelings are not under my control, but to the extent that attention is, I can direct my mind on Krishna, and then we become attracted to Krishna. We get to know him better and better. We fall in love with Krishna, and then no problem concentrating. 16-year-old boys, he's a beautiful 16-year-old girl. He doesn't have to practice any yoga to concentrate on her. Prabhupada gives that example, so we can see when there's natural attraction, then concentration is easy and natural. And actually, we love Krishna. Krishna is what we really love. And when gradually, quite naturally, that love develops. More and more, not only not thinking of other things, but thinking of Krishna with deeper and deeper, and more and more, greater and greater intensity or concentration. That will also happen, because Krishna becomes endlessly interesting and endlessly fascinating and always new. And actually, because Krishna's like that, it's a fact that in the material world, if you pay attention to anything with enough attention, it becomes interesting. I don't care what it is. If you can just manage to pay attention to it enough, it turns out to be interesting. Otherwise, I mean, and there are people who somehow or other, because of some previous impression or something from a previous life, they find rocks, for example, fascinating. And you see a bunch of rocks by the side of the road, you say, look at those stones, and some other guy, look at this, there's this, and he tells you the whole history of the world, looking at this rock, you know. Because he's become interested in rocks. So everything in the material world, this is what happens to scientists. They become interested in the world and they trip out and they never come back again. Because it's interesting. But the reason it is interesting is because the one who, that's interesting, imagine how much more interesting Krishna is. Who made it, huh? But it's true, if you can just pay attention, anything becomes interesting. And so for some reason, people are, by their karma, interested in different things. So I mean, there are people, there's a famous guy at Harvard, E.O. Wilson, who spent his whole life studying ants. And he wrote his magnum opus, is this thick, all about ants. And he says he's barely scratched the surface. Okay. You have anything to add to that? No?
Sorry?
Anything you want to add to that?
No.
Okay. Anything else? Yes.
We have many descriptions about how Krishna looks like, but these descriptions are far beyond our intelligence. Through which channel are they touching our heart?
Well, it's like this. It's the same way that the holy name touches your heart, because it's none different from Krishna. So Krishna and Krishna's name are none different. So similarly, Krishna and Krishna's description are none different. So in the beginning, I may chant the holy name and not actually perceive the real name, because the real name is Krishna himself. So I can say I don't know what Krishna means. Nevertheless, because it is Krishna's name, I can still chant his name. And if I chant with some concentration and while trying to give offenses, then gradually that name purifies me, so my senses, so that I can actually see Krishna. So the same with all these descriptions of Krishna. Chaim Om Sri Bongalalita Niyatam Prakasham. I once had some, actually there were graduate students in the religion department. They some professor and his students came to visit our temple, and they heard me give a fundamentalist Sunday feast lecture describing Krishna. And the guy said to me, "You don't take that literally, do you? You know, cows and flutes and peacock feathers and so on." And so what I said was, yeah, I do take it literally, but I can tell you this, I do not know the literal meaning. What I think I understand now, that's something like the truth. But then as I become purified more and more, the literal meaning, because that Krishna's blue. Well, is he blue like your sari? Well, no, it's a spiritual blue. What's a spiritual blue? All I've seen the material blue. Well, how is it like that blue? Well, anyway, the authorities those who have seen Krishna with their spiritual eye, they say shyama. They say dark blue. So okay, they say that, then that's the word I'll use. Somehow there's some relationship, must be, but how that spiritual blue differs from the blue in this world, well, that I'll find out when I see it. But the word is there, that has been handed down. Lord Brahma saw him. Shyama Sundar, dark blue and beautiful. Very dark blue, but like a blue, like a monsoon cloud with lightning inside. So also a radiant darkness. It's dark, he's dark, but light at the same time. That's right there, that kind of, you don't see that very often. So anyway, that's in this way.
Because some, they say you should not try, you should not try to imagine about if you read this description, you should not try, because anyway you cannot.
Oh no, I mean you can, it says a surah be cow, you can think of a cow. What are you going to do? See, read the word cow and not think of a cow? No, I don't know what you mean by imagine. I mean, beyond that, he has a peacock feather. I've heard that that peacock feather has all the colors of the rainbow and probably more than we've seen, but he plays a flute. Yeah, these are the descriptions that are given. Well, what happens when you have visuals? When you look at Radha Madan Mohan, yeah? There he is. It's very concrete, huh? You don't have to imagine. That's okay too. There's some controversy. Did Krishna wear a dhoti? It doesn't say anywhere in the Vedas that it's a dhoti. It says lower cloth. You know, so I'm sure it wasn't Levi jeans, but even though they're, but whatever it was, how the deity looks, well, Bhaktisiddhanta explains that devotees who have seen in their hearts, Premanjana Tricha Bhakti Vilochanina Santasadaiva Hridayu Vishuvilokayanti Shyamam Vibangalalita Niyatamba. They have seen Prakasham. He's been revealed in their hearts. His inconceivable qualities. They have seen the Lord in their hearts. And then out of their kindness, they have taken that image from their hearts and somehow placed it out in the world, that those of us who can't see him nevertheless can, even with our material senses, see him. But we just accept it. But by seeing the deity, bathing the deity, touching the deity, gradually I'll also see that he's none different. When Prabhupada was said, you know, what does Krishna look like? He pointed to the deity and said, just like that. He didn't, you know, pull back and say, well, sort of like that. He said, just like that. So we can accept it. And then, you know, we should try to learn how to see better. To purify our vision so we can see, because now maybe we're like driving on the road in a snowstorm, you know, we don't see the road very well. So somehow we're not seeing Krishna very well, but we'll take the remedial measures so that our vision can be improved. Okay? Anything else? Okay, thank you very much. Srila Prabhupada ki.